Richard B. Spence has been writing about espionage, about intelligence and counterintelligence for years. He maintains a journal under that name. And he's been writing about famous spies and their achievements. And this one would, I think, fall into the category of infamous spies. In fact, perhaps even notorious. Some would say evil. In any event, no matter how you categorize him, Aleister Crowley has been a character of much fascination as an occultist and somebody who had a big imprint on the way that certain people think about magic, white magic, black magic, Luciferianism. Am I pronouncing that right? All of the different things which come kind of out of the Aleister Crowley corpus. One thing I never expected was to hear that he was actually a secret agent working for the good guys. Or was he? We'll explore that next in Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence, and the Occult. Could Aleister Crowley have been involved in the sinking of the Lusitania? Well, Richard B. Spence, I'm looking forward to this conversation in that you have written a meticulously well-researched book. I appreciate all of the footnotes and your approach to your own claims. So good evening, and thanks for giving us the time on Aleister Crowley tonight.
Well, good evening, Ian.
Now, help us categorize Aleister Crowley, Richard, for people that don't know everything about him or only hear his name. This is a figure of the late 19th, early 20th century. And I'll leave the rest of you to, if you do a thumbnail quickly for the uninitiated into the work and the life of Aleister Crowley.
Well, set him in, I guess, a time frame. He's born in 1875. He dies in 1947. So late 19th, early 20th century. And I guess if Aleister Crowley is known for any one thing, it's probably being the sort of poster boy for 20th century occultism. I think most modern, I'm sure some people would take exceptions to this, but probably most modern currents of occultism in some way connect back to Crowley and his influence. Probably his influence has increased considerably since his death, as it was before. Maybe I'll give you an example of that and backtrack a bit. In 2002, the BBC polled its listeners and viewers to come up with a list of the 100 most important Britons of all time. And Winston Churchill, I think, was number one. And lo and behold, at number 73 is Aleister Crowley. I'm not sure what Crowley himself would have thought of that, but it puts him in some interesting company. There are also, maybe there are several Aleister Crowleys out there. I mean, there are people to this day who are people who are his followers, who see him as a prophet, the founder of a new religious ethic. On the opposite extreme, there are people who hate him like the devil, and in fact probably consider him to be the devil, or at least something very close to that. That was something that went back fairly early on in his career. His enemies in the British press, and I might say that one of the things about Crowley is he's an interesting example of someone who fell afoul of the tabloid press and never lived it down. It's the press, for instance, who gave him the nickname the wickedest man in the world, and another, a man we'd like to hang. But they
weren't the ones who gave him the nickname the Beast. That distinction goes to his mom.
To his mother. Yeah. That's right. I think one of the things that I think people knowledgeable of Crowley probably appreciate this, but more generally, he was actually raised, and I guess what we would categorize today as a kind of very strict, exclusive, fundamentalist Christian home.
Yeah, he was a PK. If you think about it, right? He was a preacher's kid.
He was a preacher's kid.
And he kind of came out funny like a lot of preacher's kids do, and what I work very hard to not have my kids do,
yeah,
which
I'm,
is
I'm
that
glad
they kind
you
of react.
That as opposed to me, but yeah, I've known some preacher's kids who haven't quite gone the Crowley route, but maybe close to that. But and I, you know, that's one of these things that I think probably had an influence on it. You know, his father spent much of his life. His father was actually a fairly wealthy man. The family made their money, by the way, off of beer.
Right, and then but then spent a lifetime in a way in a very, very strict upbringing where he wasn't even as a boy, he wasn't even allowed to play with kids that weren't part of their particular religious group, right?
I mean, because everybody else was going to hell.
Right. I'm trying to break myself of the habit of saying Crowley. You say Crowley, and that would be probably the best pronunciation then?
Well, people pronounce it one way or the other, and I guess I was corrected some time ago that the proper way to pronounce it was holy moly. It's Aleister Crowley.
I'll go with you on that.
I may actually slip and say Crowley. I work with a fellow whose name is Crowley, so I keep calling him Crowley, and he goes, what?
All right, so let's just say then, Aleister Crowley was raised in a strict upbringing, had the benefits of family money, had the benefit of extraordinary natural gifts. He was a good writer right away, personable kind of guy, and somebody who exceeded expectations at university level. What happened to him? How did he end up becoming an occultist?
Well, one way to think of it is his father was a preacher, and I say in his own way, he follows in his father's footsteps. His father was preaching his version of the gospel, and Crowley was going to create, he was going to go further than that. Rather than sort of preach the existing gospel or the Plymouth Brethren's gospel, he was going to invent his own religion. But he does become, in a sense, a preacher. Now, maybe not one you'd ordinarily think of. What happens? One of the things that you're always tempted to do this, and any time you're working on an individual, is to try to sit back and play armchair psychoanalyst.
Right.
And, I'll admit that you have to try to figure out what people's motivations are, but it's one of those things that one of the things I don't try to do in the book is to explain what makes this guy tick. I'm not sure you can do that with any individual. I think a lot of it has to do with temperament. There is something, again, maybe it's being raised in a kind of emotional pressure cooker. His father died when he was fairly young, I think around the age of 10 or 11. That seems to have had an influence on him.
Right.
His relationship with his mother was tempestuous, and yet there's some kind of she lives on for years, and there's a connection to her. One person who actually was a follower of Crowley's, which I should say as a disclaimer, I'm not.
Okay? Right.
So if anybody out there is wondering, am I a Thelemite, someone who is one of his followers, I'm not. I don't have anything against it, but I'm not part of that group.
And there are a lot out there to this day, and there were even in his own day, obviously he had followers, people who immediately took up his banner, and he was a successfully published author and a writer of many articles. His hymn to Lucifer remains an inspiration to rock groups in different places. He's a guy who was on to something in his own way, not my way, but in his own way. And people in Victorian or post-Victorian England responded completely to his message in large pockets.
Well, part of that, I think, and this is something that I tried to bring out in the book and was really a surprise to me as I wrote it, is part of his popularity is connected to the fact that the occultism interest in what we'd call the paranormal, the supernatural, was very widespread at the time. I mean, he's not an exclusive phenomenon. He was already he was sort of preaching his particular gospel to a society in which an awareness and an interest in the supernatural, in the occult, were fairly pervasive. And one of the things that one of the questions often comes up is maybe not so much what makes him tick, but what attracted people to him, because he was could be attractive and charming, but if you actually go through his career, you'll find out that he tended to lose a lot more friends than he kept.
Right.
He was not an easy man to get along with. If nothing else, he was extremely egotistical. One of the things you can do if you're interested is just basically look at his relationships with women, which, if nothing else, were interesting and usually emotionally painful to both parties involved.
Right.
A number of them ended up in insane asylums or as alcoholics or drug addicts. He himself became a heroin addict through most of his of his adult life.
Yeah, but those some of those people that ended up that way were probably on that trajectory when he met them, which is probably why they had a mutual attraction.
That could, I mean, that's certainly the question that comes to mind about his relationships with women. I mean, did he drive them crazy, or were they halfway there to begin with? Was right, that the type of woman that was attracted to Aleister Crowley?
Were they driving?
Go ahead.
Were they driving themselves crazy, and he was just pushing on the back fender at the same time?
I think in some cases, I think it varies from one woman to another, but often they are very intelligent,
all right,
quite accomplished on their own.
So let's just sum it up by saying, here's Aleister Crowley going against the current of Victorian and post-Victorian England, becomes a popular occultist, invents his own religious tradition, this Thelemic tradition, which people still practice today. He was somebody who was very magnetic, but also, as the poles of that can indicate, he also was very repulsive to people as well as attractive. And he was somebody who was a gifted writer and somebody who seemingly had sort of this restless spirit, dabbled in white magic, black magic, bisexual, orgies. I mean, this was a guy who, whatever it was that he wanted to do, he did it. And that was the basic theme of do as thou wilt, right? He's really the guy who's credited with inventing that. That is the whole of the law. Do as thou wilt, correct?
He actually borrows it from somebody else, but he popularizes it.
Okay,
so
fair
those
enough.
Are the people who tend to get credit for things, the ones who popularize.
That's right. Good writers borrow, great writers steal.
Right. So he understood that pretty well.
But I've never heard, and you are the first person that I kind of looked around on this, who ever made a claim that he was also a secret agent. Now, just start with that.
Well, it's one of those things that's addressed. I mean, first of all, I should say that there are many Aleister Crowley biographies out there. And one of the things that my book is not really intended to be is a total biography. What I'm focusing on largely is his connection to intelligence, mostly British intelligence, and how basically if you go back and look at different phases of his life, different activities, you know, his presence in World War I New York and 1930s Germany, that there is, in almost all of these cases, there's some intelligence agenda, his or someone else, which is there. Now, Crowley probably got his start. I mean, you go back to his family. His family was not only fairly wealthy, it was surprisingly well-connected. And one of the people who probably plays an influential role in his drift into Secret Service work, whether she knew it or not, was an aunt, actually an aunt by marriage, Aunt Annie Crowley. See, I almost slipped there. And one of the things that she did, she was a big contributor. She was a politically active woman. And the two big parties in Britain in that period were pretty much the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party, or the Tories. She was a big contributor to the Tory party. It was probably with her influence that he managed to get into Cambridge. Didn't finish it, but he did manage to get in. And one of the things that he was, I think as you've noted, he was intelligent. He was physically brave, which I don't think a lot of people would give him credit for, but I guess you got to be physically brave to summon demons. But also one of his things was that he was a mountain climber. In fact, he was a world-class mountain climber early on in his career. So he was daring, a man who liked to take risks in any number of ways, a fellow who was not, we could also say that he wasn't overly constrained by conventional morality. Now, if you begin to put those things together and you think of what might be useful attributes for a spy, what might be useful attributes for a person who in certain situations is going to have to seem to be something that they're not, may have to lie, might have to steal, might even have to kill under certain circumstances. Well, the things we've just got over give him a certain amount of recommendation for that. He was a likely young man, and there were always people who were looking for likely young men. And there's something of a hint. I think the first real hint that I found, and I'd have to say here, I backtracked to where I sort of came into this story, and it may be a little bit on, I'll explain how that happened, was that I really began to focus on his activities in World War I, New York. And that was where I came across an American document that said quite clearly that he was an employee of the British government. So what I began to do, though, is to sort of go back and say, all right, well, let's take this back further. Did this begin in 1914, or did it go back? And basically, back in his college days, around 1896, he actually recounts this in his sort of autobiography. He's in Stockholm, Sweden, and it's there that he's – mostly what he's talking about is he undergoes some kind of emotional crisis. And this is really, you know, in a way where his path towards occultism begins. He was seeking – one of the things that I think, again, this goes back to his religious upbringing, he's looking for contact with the divine. Now, people do that in different ways. You can look for a contact with a divine through Jesus. You can look at contact with the divine through the devil. You can try to find things in between. But he was seeking that contact with the other. And I think that's one of the things that permeates his life. So he was going through this kind of early searching phase that's going to lead him into his life of occultism. But for reasons he never quite explains, he's in Stockholm, and he undergoes this sort of, you know, midnight of the soul. Well, here's where things began to begin. What was he doing in Stockholm? Where was he going? And one of the things that I found by going through records was that just before that departure, he'd received a British passport. That doesn't sound too unusual, except in the 1890s, almost nobody got passports. They were not the kind of basic document you would need. Most countries, for instance, Britain didn't require citizens to have passports. Most countries didn't require British citizens to have them when they came in. In fact, there were only a handful of countries. Japan was one. Well, he wasn't good. Sweden didn't require it. That's the main thing. So he didn't need it to go to Sweden. Well, certainly wasn't going to go to Japan. The Ottoman Empire, Turkey was another. Not going to Turkey. But the other one, the most prominent country that insisted upon passports from all foreigners, was Tsarist Russia. Now, this is something else where, again, if you go through Crowley's writings, you'll notice that early on, when he's in college, he's thinking about a career in the diplomatic service. And he goes, the place where I wanted to be posted was St. Petersburg. That's where I would want to go.
Hmm.
Now, at this particular time, late 19th century, Russia, not Germany, is the British Empire's main enemy. This is all part of what's called the Great Game, the dueling of Russian and British secret agents, really from China to Afghanistan. Afghanistan still figures then as now. Tibet, all of this was kind of this huge chessboard in which these empires were moving their pawns around. So one of the things is that to be posted even as a junior diplomat in Russia basically meant you were going to be in the thick of some intelligence activity. Russia was busy spying on the British Empire, and the British Empire was busy spying on Russia. And if you were going to go to the capital of the Russian Empire, you were going to have to be prepared for that. So this goes back, what was he doing in Stockholm? What was happening? He doesn't need a passport to go there. The only country in any kind, and Stockholm was the main jumping-off point for Russia.
Right.
Everything suggests that he was on his way to Russia.
Well, let's break that off here, and we'll come back to this. Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult. Richard B. Spence is our guest, and we'll move this along a bit coming up here in just a few minutes, because it's so interesting to think, like so many other people were, that he could have been recruited out of college, ends up in New York, and ends up being a central player in the sinking of the Lusitania. And then later, in pre-war Nazi Germany, what was he doing there, too, all the time being a public iconoclast? Was he privately just another loyal patriot? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So here is Aleister Crowley, a man born of privilege, a man who is at Cambridge, which I think would be fair enough to describe Richard B. Spence as sort of a traditional hunting grounds, a shallow pool for prospects for British intelligence, right? I mean, British intelligence and Cambridge have been going hand in hand now for over 100 years.
Well, yeah, British intelligence and, you know, it's the recruiting ground for the whole, certainly the establishment in that period. If it isn't Cambridge, it's Oxford. But those of you who got into there, you were marked for something. Again, he didn't quite live up to his initial potential. He didn't go into the diplomatic service. And he later, of course, argued basically that, I had better things to do. I was going to become the prophet of the new aeon. My spiritual pursuits are... That probably is true to some extent. On the other hand, I'm always left wondering, and there are lots of things about him that I'm left wondering, is just what happened back in Stockholm that wintry evening. What did he screw up? Was it a successful outing, or was there did he lose his nerve? Was there something?
What do you think the mission was? I mean, if you were imagine what a typical mission might have been for a fledgling agent, somebody who had gotten obviously, as you said, a passport to go into Russia, and here's a guy who, looks on the surface anyway very counterculture, maybe somebody that the Russians might have thought, well, we have nothing to fear from this guy, or however it was that he made his way in there. What do you think he was up to, at least publicly? And what do you think he was that he could have screwed up that ended up sort of truncating his diplomatic future, or for that matter, his proper service?
Well, certainly either he or somebody else decided that he wasn't cut out to be a diplomat, and it was suspect there was probably something on both sides. What might be a kind of simple test for a Tyro secret agent? You simply send them into enemy territory, and they look around. You test their powers of observation. That's one of the main things it is going to be used for. You're going to go into places. You're going to observe, and then you're going to come back and tell us what it was that you observed. There might be a particular target for that observation. There might be simply one to see how well you can. To what degree can you blend in? All British subjects in Russia at that time were suspect to some degree or another. He was certainly going to get some. One of the things that the Tsar had in that period was a very good intelligence and counterintelligence service. That was mostly to keep his own people in line, but it was also to keep an eye on foreigners. So I don't think he was going to do anything daring. Part of it could have been that he lost his nerve in Stockholm, and he never got there. Another could have been that, another aspect of this is that maybe he didn't fail. Maybe they decided that his abilities as an observer were something that might be wasted inside an embassy. Maybe this was a young man who had other type of potential. There's also the whole element of, I think, as I mentioned before, that you have to keep in mind that his occultism for the time and place, and even today, I mean, look, occultism, the supernatural, the paranormal, whatever terms you want to attach to it, I mean, the very success of Coast to Coast AM is to some degree connected to those topics. There's a huge amount of interest out there, and there always has been. And I think that was something that I didn't really appreciate fully before working on this, is the degree to how pervasive the influence of these organizations were, and at fairly high levels.
Interesting.
That is, there were people who were, he wasn't the only person involved in, let's say, a cult spiritual quest. There were lots of others.
All right, No, go ahead. I just wanted to move it to another part of that, but I don't mean to stop you from where you're going. If you because I think that's the interesting part about what he does and who he is. So let's just say something happens, as you mentioned, in Stockholm, and maybe he's found to be a lousy diplomat. Maybe they think, we've got the right guy, we got the wrong job for you, and we're gonna stick him in a different, career path. What's the first evidence you see of, though, other than his own writing where things get mentioned a little bit, what's the first evidence you see of him actually acting as a secret agent for the British government?
I think it had to do with his connection with an occult organization. In fact, one of his more famous connections with a group. This is just around 1899, 1900, so it's a few years further on, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was one of many occult organizations in late Victorian Britain. And, they all promised the same thing. Join us and you'll get the secrets of the universe. You will attain great wisdom and power and commune with the forces beyond. And that was certainly something that interested him. I mean, here was a group that was claiming to offer that kind of enlightenment that he was after. It's also pretty typical of a lot of other organizations. Almost most of its members started out in Freemasonry. They then gravitated to the more exclusive Rosicrucian orders, and then the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was basically recruited out of people who'd gone through those. The groups become increasingly exclusive as they go along. Now, the basic story is that he became associated with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and very was one of the younger members, and he wanted to move through it very quickly. He was very impatient. He wanted to go. The whole process here was that you were initiated one level or another, and he wanted to move fast. Other people in the organization weren't so sure they wanted this, you know, kid to move that fast. And eventually, what he helped provoke was something that was probably going to happen anyway, and usually happen with these groups: internal dissension. A huge explosion within the group, and pretty much by the time he left it, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was, if not totally destroyed, it was in shambles. It never actually recovered. Now, beneath that aspect, though, one of the things that gradually emerged is that, and here again, as I think something, a theme that goes through the book, is that very often I found that if you look at occult organizations, underneath, there is a political agenda, and there's also the reverse of that. You can look at political organizations and find that running through it is a kind of occult agenda. There is this connection between the two. That's part of this whole world that Crowley moves in, this connection between intelligence, you know, which is like war, politics by another means, and politics. And the occult, a number of people connected to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and other people connected to them were members of what we might call dissident political organizations. And the overall goal of these groups were to carry out regime change in various European countries, including Britain. And the type of regime change they wanted is that these people saw themselves as legitimists. That's the way they were described in Britain. They believed, for instance, that Queen Victoria and her whole line were usurpers. In Britain, they believed that the Stuart line, going all the way back to Mary, Queen of Scots, that those were the rightful sovereigns of Britain. Others were connected with, you also begin to look closely at some of the members of the Golden Dawn, guys like William Butler Yeats, another notable poet. They're Irish patriots. Remember, one of the things that Britain, the British Empire, was fighting even then was Irish separatism, Irish revolutionary movements. And if you begin to look at the members of this, and you find that there's this whole current moving through here of Celtic nationalism, Irish separatism, bringing back the Stuarts. And it's not just Britain. It's then connected to efforts to change the monarchy in Spain to replace the reigning Spanish monarchy with another family. And then you find out that a fellow by the name of Samuel MacGregor Mathers, who was one of the sort of grand old men of the Golden Dawn by this time, he's living in Paris. He is actually the guy that Crowley sidles up to get an introduction into the group. But MacGregor Mathers is involved with other people who are doing things like, well, they're buying guns in Germany to put aboard a boat chartered in England to send to incite a rebellion in Spain. Now, one of the people who ends up on the crew of a boat loaded with guns, which is supposed to go and help this rebellion, is a certain crewman who is listed as C. E. Alexander. Now, one of the things about Aleister Crowley to keep in mind is that his real name is Edward Alexander Crowley.
Right.
And that's him. He's on the boat. What happens in the process of this is that somebody, maybe it's him, maybe it isn't, somehow it gets tipped off to French authorities and the whole thing falls apart. What is averted in this, though, would have been a major scandal for the British. Because remember, this is put this in a modern sense. You find out that a group of political plotters in your country are sort of running a military training camp, and they're sort of planning their own Bay of Pigs in Spain. And they've got a boatload of German guns that they're trying to send to Spain. Now, if that was to happen and the rebellion was to break out, that could be very embarrassing. This is the type of thing that responsible people in London would want a person on the inside of to let them know what was going on, and certainly, if necessary, to make sure things fell apart. I don't think his presence in that group or aboard the boat was, and also to basically destroy the organization this was based around. And that is really the type of role that Crowley is going to play. His main role as a spy is pretty much as a kind of undercover informant and provocateur. It's the same kind of role he's going to play with the Germans later on.
Yeah, I think the provocateur part is a really interesting thought, because he certainly was provoking. It would fit his image. It seems to come to him naturally to be that provocative and to get people to react to him. I guess the boat reminds me, and so let's go ahead and make the connection already between that work and then later why you suspect he may have been the main guy maybe in the execution of the plot against the Lusitania. Can you set the table on the Lusitania for people that that haven't researched it over the years?
Well, it's one of the big usually two naval disasters or maritime disasters in the 20th century. The big one is the Titanic, and then there's the Lusitania. Difference between the two: Titanic hits an iceberg, drowns hundreds of people. The Lusitania is torpedoed. And this takes place in the early part of 1950, in the early part of World War I, and the Lusitania was sailing. It had left New York, and it was on its way back to its home port of Liverpool. It also was sort of the pride of the British Cunard liner fleet. It was a big ship, and it was the sort of flagship of the major line. So there was a certain propaganda advantage to sinking it. But, of course, there was a problem. Since it was plying the New York to Liverpool route, it was always carrying a lot of Americans. And I guess one of the things that a lot of modern Americans sometimes forget is that through most of the First World War, the USA was neutral. We don't come into the war until halfway through 1917, and it starts back in the summer of 1914. And one of the great desires, one of the whole things that the key to understanding what Crowley was doing in New York, his whole mission in the U.S., was that there was early on a very strong determination, an almost desperate determination on the part of people in London to bring the United States into the war. And that was for the same reason that was manifested later. The U.S. had a lot of men. More importantly, it had a lot of money.
Right.
And huge industrial power, they could be put at that. And, the First World War was kind of, it wasn't right up almost to the end. It wasn't sure what direction it was going to go. There was no assurance in this period that, Britain was allied to France. They weren't too certain about the French in some respects. They were also allied to Russia, and as things eventually turned out, the Russians didn't stay in the war.
Right.
They would collapse. The other thing is that very early on, the U.S. is a source of money. It's a very rich, neutral country, and therefore it essentially puts much of its, individual American businessmen like J.P. Morgan and Company, which become the exclusive agents for the British government and the Allied powers in purchasing. So while the U.S. government, and this is a little detail that shouldn't be overlooked, the U.S. government was neutral in 1915. J.P. Morgan and Company was not. They were wholly committed to the Allied and especially the British cause. They advanced them hundreds of millions of dollars, and that was an important stake in eventual victory. So one of the things already come up is that, we need to get the Yankees into the war. It would be much more effective to do that way. And also all these private loans would become public loans. Now, this is something that Crowley himself later admitted in a diary that he kept. He was a great keeper of diaries. So he's not even making this as a public statement, but later on, sort of go up a little bit, in the early part of 1917, when Woodrow Wilson is the first step towards declaring war, breaks diplomatic relations with Germany, Crowley makes this very interesting and very sort of personal note. My 2.5 years' work has reached completion. America is going to enter the war. Now, was he just fantasizing that he had played a role in this, or what had he done? Why? What did he think that had happened? So the Lusitania is a big ship. It's also a ship that the British, in some respects, had used unwisely. Early on in the war, they decided they were going to make it a kind of auxiliary warship, and somebody came up with this bright idea of, we're going to mount guns on it. And there were actually gun mountings that were there. Cooler has eventually pointed out that this is a huge, slow-going ocean liner which simply provides a gigantic target. Okay, it's not strong enough to fight other warships. And by making it an auxiliary cruiser, we're certainly going to set it up for destruction. So they changed that, but these gun mountings were still there, and the Germans were suspicious and kept getting these tip-offs that the British had guns hidden aboard the Lusitania. And that this was, and therefore they were still, you know, the British were sneaky in the Germans' mind. They were going to use it this way. Something else the Germans were aware of, which was quite true, is that the Lusitania, although primarily a passenger vessel, was being used to carry military supplies. Now, it didn't carry guns or, you know, machine guns, but it was carrying things like, shell casings. All right. And the argument was that if you don't actually put the powder in the shell and put the explosive shell in it, it's not actually war material. Nobody believed that, certainly not the Germans. And this is why later the argument was, you know, the Germans sinking the Lusitania was, well, it was really bad PR, but it was kind of legitimate. That is, they could actually claim that there was a reason for doing it. But it was
that mostly, it wasn't purely a passenger ship. This was a
passenger
This is a subterfuge by the British government and the Americans to slip munitions into England under the neutral flag of a so-called passenger ship.
But the interesting thing about it is that the British weren't all that sneaky about it. They don't make a huge effort to disguise that there are some materials aboard the ship. This has led some people, it certainly is an idea original with me, Colin Simpson is a fellow who some years back wrote a book basically arguing that the sinking of the Lusitania was a British plot. And it was a British plot designed to provoke the Germans into doing something really stupid. Because if you sank the Lusitania, you were undoubtedly going to kill a large number of Americans who traveled on the ship, and that this would be a way of enraging American public opinion and possibly bringing the country into the war. So Simpson's argument, he goes and has a rather elaborate argument that, in fact, the whole ship was crammed with munitions, and that's one of the reasons why it sank. So, you know, that maybe what they originally wanted to do was just to have it sink slowly so not too many people be killed and turn into a bigger disaster. From my standpoint, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't even really make any difference whether there are any munitions on there or not. The main thing that but there certainly was this desire to, I mean, for the Germans, this was a complete public relations disaster. And if it didn't bring America into the war, it set the stage for that.
But for the British, this could be a classic false flag operation.
Yeah.
And let's just leave it there and get right back to it then. What Richard B. Spence, the author of Secret Agent 666, argues is the likely explanation coming up on how Aleister Crowley helped sink the Titanic, how the British government was instrumental in the destruction of that ship, of setting up that ship for that torpedo. We'll tell you more about that coming up next. The book is Secret Agent 666 on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, there's no doubt that Aleister Crowley, a famous occultist, author, somebody who was moving and shaking up the Victorian world in England, spent some time in the United States. Nobody is denying that. Nobody denies that she appeared to live a dissolute's life, going from one little odd job to another, never really finding his feet, as it were, in the career path of his choice. However, what Aleister Crowley does do is perhaps something much more nefarious. He's spying. He's gathering information. When we left the story off, Aleister Crowley was not in England anymore, but rather in the UK. I'm sorry, rather in the United States, the U.S. And here he was doing what? Gathering information, perhaps. And perhaps, argues Richard B. Spence, he was setting the table for the sinking of the Lusitania. We'll explain how Aleister Crowley, occultist, could end up being responsible for that to history next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, again, we're talking with Richard B. Spence, author of Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult. We established last half hour the importance of the Lusitania, how it was going to be used as a false flag operation, perhaps, to lure the United States and its money and its resources and its industries into World War One, into the Great War. And Aleister Crowley may have played a part in this, but how? Richard?
Well, let's go back to when he leaves England in October 1914. War's been going on for a while, but still early on. Guess which ship he sails on? The Lusitania. So on Halloween, and I don't know whether you planned it that way or not, on October 31st, 1914, he sails into New York aboard the Lusitania. Now, one of the interesting things is that if you look at his, you know, they collected information on travelers, and so it's revealing to, in his case and others, to often look at the kind of details that people gave down, how much money he had with him. He wasn't broke. He actually had a nice little chunk of change with him. He also, interestingly enough, declared himself to be Irish. Now, Aleister Crowley is not in any sense of the word Irish. The name Crowley or Crowley can be Irish, but he wasn't. He's not Irish. I'm not sure he even ever set foot in the place. So this is kind of interesting. He comes into the United States, and he's declaring himself Irish. There's a deliberate reason for that, and it's one of the things that shows clear premeditation in terms of what follows next. But also just go to the simple fact that he arrived aboard the Lusitania. And remember, one of the things that the Germans were going to be very curious about, were suspicious about, was whether or not the Lusitania had guns hidden aboard it. Now, as a passenger aboard the ship, and as a man who would then immediately thereafter, once he lands in New York, he infiltrates the British, he infiltrates the German propaganda cabinet in New York. The Germans had their own sort of intelligence operation there, and the center of this, though, the body that was secretly attempting to influence American public opinion, the British were trying to influence American public opinion, the Germans were trying, they had money, secret bank accounts, this was also where sabotage was organized against Allied war production. Crowley puts himself right in the middle of that. He gets a job writing for a pro-German magazine called The Fatherland, run by a German-American by the name of George Sylvester Viereck. And guess what also was run out of The Fatherland's offices? The propaganda cabinet. He went right into the heart of the enemy organization.
Was he fluent in German?
I don't think so. But that wasn't – he certainly had some. But almost all of these people spoke English. Viereck, for instance, was basically an American. And it's Viereck who brings him into the, not only brings him into this circle, it's Viereck who gives him a job writing for the Fatherland, where Crowley, by the way, writes these really, fire-breathing anti-British articles. You know, he describes the king as an obscene dwarf. When the Germans, for instance, execute a British nurse in Belgium by the name of Edith Cavell, another very bad PR move, he applauds that, basically arguing that she had it coming. Turns out she actually was a spy, but that's another story. But so he tends to encourage one of the things that he encourages among the Germans is this kind of forceful, one way to influence the Americans, he argues, is not necessarily with reason, is to show the Americans how strong and determined Germany is, that Germany is going to fight this war tough. The Americans, he basically argues, are their children in this type of thing. They're not a great power, which in a sense they were not. Economically they were, but not militarily. They have no experience with it, and the Americans are playing a dangerous game by putting financial resources to our enemies, and we need to scare them. We need to really give these Yankees a good shock, and we need to show them just how tough and determined we are. And that's why something like sinking the Lusitania would show that. But the Germans had to be convinced. I mean, this was still a kind of tricky thing to do. This is a liner. There certainly were people in Berlin and in New York. And keep in mind, many of the people in Berlin were relying upon who for their perceptions? Their agents in New York. And who was influencing German perceptions in New York? Aleister Crowley.
Okay.
So keep in mind, one of the things that he could very easily attest to is that, well, I was on the Lusitania when I came over. And guess what I saw? Guns hidden under deck.
So he also had
one of his girlfriends that came over a few months later, Lila Waddell. She came over on the Lusitania, I think, on its last voyage. And he could bring her out, and he goes, look, here's an Australian woman. Okay,
right.
What did you see aboard the ship, Lila? I saw guns under the deck.
Right. So it already sets the table for some sort of attack. It legitimizes an attack. But the claim here is, though, is not that he's doing this out of just some sort of twisted sense of patriotism to the Germans, but rather out of sort of some orders from England that says, help us, get the Germans to sink the Lusitania? I mean, just to make sure I understand this clearly, and what connection do we have? Is there anything that shows that he got this order from the Brits to tell the Germans, go ahead and sink her?
Who would put that in a written order would be the question I would come back with.
Well, you're a historian. I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Now we have 70 years or 80 years behind us, is there any proof at all? Is there anything where anybody said before they died, oh, yes, Aleister Crowley, he was one of our agents?
No, because they're never going to tell you that someone is an agent. There's usually an implicit deal which is made between an agency and agents. Now, remember, there's a difference between an agent and an officer. That is someone who's an actual employee of the government, the type of person who runs agents. And this is one of the things that you'll be told if you try to go on and get people to confirm, you know, that it was so-and-so your agent, and it's true for the, you know, the old KGB, it's true for the CIA, it's true for... In fact, the Valerie Plame case is an example of that. One of the things you're never supposed to do is to name agents, even agents that have been dead for 70 years. Hmm. Because the implicit deal here is that what you do for us, you don't talk about.
Right.
You keep your mouth shut about it. You never
plausible
say what you did.
Plausible deniability cuts both ways.
Right. And at the same time, we will never reveal you. Now, sometimes agencies make an exception to do that, but... usually the people who are conveniently dead, but generally they're pretty serious about it, and that's something that I've run up against more than once. You know, just this idea that we're never going to admit who was an agent, who wasn't.
Well, again, we're talking with Richard Spence. He's the author of Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult, and how Aleister Crowley may have been a British agent acting as a provocateur to get the Germans to sink the Lusitania. Let me fast forward just a little bit. Talk about Ian Fleming and Aleister Crowley.
Well, Ian Fleming, there's a link here. And one of the things to keep in mind, if you're talking about British intelligence, you're not talking about a single entity. And there's, you know, there's what will become MI5, which is foreign intelligence, whether it's sort of internal domestic intelligence, MI6, which is foreign intelligence. And then there's the one that Crowley's really connected to in World War I New York is British naval intelligence. And I think a work that would give a good deal of background on that is Patrick Beasley's Room 40, which discusses, he talks about the Lusitania. The boss of this was a very clever, very devious man, very interesting man, by the name of Admiral Reginald, his name was Blinker Hall. That's basically Crowley's ultimate boss in this period. And I think the simplest way to put it, and people can investigate for themselves, was Admiral Hall the type of man that would be willing to sacrifice an ocean liner to win a war? He absolutely was. Now, there's the agency that I think going from this period, if you go from the World War I period, we sort of segue up into World War II. You know, we're going 20 years later. When World War II breaks out in September 1939, Aleister Crowley gets an invitation. He gets a little card from the man who's then the head of British Naval Intelligence, Admiral John Godfrey, to come and have a talk with him. That's a kind of an interesting thing. You know, by this time, Crowley's really old. He certainly is notorious, generally despised and feared by most people. But interestingly enough, when Britain finds itself at war again, within days of the declaration of war, who is it that the chief of British naval intelligence decides ought to come by for a chat? Old Aleister Crowley. And who is the right-hand man to John Godfrey? A young naval intelligence officer by the name of Ian Fleming. Now, that then takes us off in a number of other directions. But particularly in the direction of Rudolf Hess and his sort of bizarre antics at the time. But one of the things, for instance, that Godfrey in naval intelligence was interested in, one of the things we know certainly that they did that has been recently, in fact, MI5, I think, recently declassified one of its files. They do this every now and then. And a fellow by the name of Louis de Wahl. Louis de Wahl was actually a Hungarian-born astrologer. And they employed him. He had an astrologer working for British intelligence to cook up phony astrological predictions to feed them back into Nazi Germany, where it was assumed more or less correctly that there were a lot of high-ranking Nazis who ate this stuff up.
Right, including Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, including Adolf Hitler. And even more than him, certainly Hess, who tended to be in many ways sort of governed by the stars in this case. So this is where you have to think in mind that, you know, if Godfrey's going to employ an astrologer, a Hungarian one nonetheless, who's, you know, a foreigner, it's not too strange that he would sort of, you know, pick up an old native-born occultist from the past to do a little work as well.
I think that's all very intriguing, and I wanted to just establish that Ian Fleming actually does say in somewhere in his writings that that Aleister Crowley was a contact of theirs and somebody that they had considered and or used.
Yes, in fact, one of the things he says is that one of our unfulfilled desires was to have him interview Rudolf Hess. Hess was sort of Hitler's number two man, a very high-ranking figure in the Third Reich, who is, you know, the best way to describe it, usually it's done, is that Hess sort of got some sort of, you know, strange idea that he could negotiate peace with the British, so he hopped into a plane and flew across the North Sea and crash-landed in Scotland and was taken prisoner, where he pretty much remained for the rest of his life. So was this either just a sort of goofy idea on his part, or was there some real possibility? You know, one of the things it turns out, there really were a lot of people in England at that time willing to negotiate or at least contemplate peace. If you go back and look at it, the war was not going well for the British Empire.
Right.
So it wasn't this completely insane action that some might suppose. In fact, one of the things we also have is that Crowley himself offered to interrogate Hess. And his basis of this was that, you know, this guy is interested in occultism.
Right.
See, part of Crowley's credentials, one of the things that actually, even if he's feared and despised, as he develops a reputation as an accomplished occultist, that then makes him potentially influential on others who are either of the like mind. For instance, the fellow I mentioned before, the head of the fellow who brought Crowley into the German network in New York, Viereck. Viereck is fascinated with all things occult. He's a member of various lodges, like to attend orgies, apparently. And that's part of it. This is one of the things that the sort of literally, I think in some ways maybe, the kind of magic that Crowley can work upon people.
Right.
And he either bamboozles Viereck and other people totally, or one of the things that I suspect, and this is, you know, I'd say it's purely a suspicion, Crowley was quite capable in using sort of experimental uses of drugs on people, but also hypnotism. And I'm quite curious as the degree to which he may have used one or both of those in his way to sort of, you know, the type of thing that the CIA did in the 1950s.
Sure.
What were they constantly trying to do? Control people's minds or get inside them by drugs and hypnotism.
Right.
And that's really a case of where I think Crowley is a kind of pioneer.
So we have to go back to the pre-sinking of the Lusitania. We have him in New York. We have him writing for German propaganda publications, selling out Britain, supposedly, showing how the Lusitania had you know, gun mounts, if not actual guns, and that this was a ship of war, and therefore, under the rules of war, fair to sink. And is that just the extent of his participation in the plot to sink the Lusitania?
No. One of the things, just to add a little caveat here, that the sort of plot, and I think that is basically a plot involving the Lusitania, is a fairly complex affair, and I try to lay out more of that in the book. Crowley plays a role in it, but I'm certainly not going to try to argue that he does this single-handedly. He's part of a much larger operation, which is basically to get the Germans to do something provocative, something that will alarm the American population. No, well, he's in the U.S. from 1914 all the way up to the end of 1919. He's there thereafter. And I'll give you an example of something that I think some of your listeners will probably recognize. One of the places or terms that has probably cropped up on more than one show is Montauk Point, Long Island. Remember, this is the place that's supposed to have, even today, some kind of mysterious underground base. I think Al Bielek and the whole Philadelphia experiment, disappearing ship mythos, somehow connects with this. People have got pyramids there. I don't know. It tends to have a particular sort of ominous role. Well, one of the places that actually, after the war was over, but before he returned to England, that Crowley went for what he called a magical retreat. He would go off to remote places, pitch a tent, and commune with the spirits, which I think he did. But also, there's always been this, why Montauk Point, which is out at the very far extreme end of Long Island. And that's where, this is one of these things where a whole series of very strange, provocative threads began to interconnect. And I'll tell you, this is one of the cases where I'll admit that I'm not entirely sure what it is I'm looking at or what we're looking at, but there's something going on. And there's something, certainly something more. The main thing I found out is that he pitches his tent in a very highly and militarized and sensitive area. Okay, he doesn't go where there's nobody at. He goes right next door to the Montauk Point Naval Air Station. There'd also been a large military base. There's also at the end of the electrified Long Island Railway. So one of the things that you have out, supposedly in this remote place, is like a huge amount of electrical power, and you've got not only a naval air station, but one which is still in operation in the summer of 1919 and doing something that nobody wants to talk about. There are 100 men stationed there, and when someone there's an article in the New York Times about it. When someone asks, why hasn't this place been closed down and these men sent home? Well, they're all volunteers and we're working on stuff. Later on, this place is turned into, it's an experimental weapon station. At the time, it was also being used to experiment with what was called ground radio or undersea radio.
Right.
But there's also another sort of, that at the very least is going to be interesting to British naval intelligence. And if you wonder why, well, what was one of the main reasons why Britain went to war with Germany? Germany was building the world's second biggest navy. British don't like that. Okay,
right.
They wanted to maintain naval superiority. Now, the war is over. German navy is history. It's gone. What country then automatically became the second largest naval power in the world? The United States.
Right.
What country are the British in debt to up to their eyebrows? The United States. What country has a much greater ability to outbuild the British if they put their mind to it? The U.S. From the practical standpoint of the British Admiralty, the U.S. had become, you got to keep an idea of what these guys are up to.
Well, we'll talk more about that idea coming up in just a second. Aleister Crowley, as a secret agent and an occultist, and back to the Lusitania next on Coast to Coast AM. Not going to go to questions yet for Richard B. Spence, but coming up in the last hour we will. Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult. He is somebody who's been a historian on issues involving espionage and counter-espionage, and in this case, It's a book that focuses a lot on what Aleister Crowley was up to in the United States as an operative for British intelligence, maybe specifically for naval intelligence. No less a known figure in the espionage history than Ian Fleming, later author of the James Bond books, confirms that they were at least publicly willing to connect themselves to Aleister Crowley or Crowley in one sense. Perhaps that's only just a little bit of what they were both up to. And we'll get back to this, exactly how the Lusitania was sunk and why, and what part Aleister Crowley played in that, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So Richard B. Spence was just telling us before the break about Aleister Crowley. I'm sorry I had to cut you off there, but we were just coming up against the set at the bottom of the hour. So real quickly, want to finish that thought, because I want to get back to some of the specifics about the Lusitania, but you were going somewhere with that, and I stopped you. I don't mind stopping if you want to. I just want to make sure there wasn't a further thought at the end of that sentence that you wanted to get back to.
No. We'll get back to it at some point if it's important.
Okay. For people who don't know how the Lusitania was sunk, just go ahead and explain then real quickly, how the Lusitania ends up going down with so many people on it.
Well, it's off the coast of Ireland on it on its homeward trip, and it's torpedoed by a German U-boat, which was patrolling the area. It was something, again, that some people make an argument that it was almost set up. That, again, isn't the argument. It may have been the case, and in this case, set up by the British. I think Simpson, for instance, Colin Simpson argues that, some of the naval patrols that might have kept the U-boats at bay were not there, that the ship was sort of there as a kind of floating target. I'm not necessarily sure you have to go that far. The whole goal in this, and I think that if there's a mastermind to this, it's really Admiral Hall, is that you needed to have something catastrophic. The Germans, there certainly were people, not all Germans, but there were certainly people in New York and Berlin among the German establishment that were willing to do something like attack. I mean, the Lusitania was a target. Some people felt that they were being goaded by it. You know, that the fact that the British would put war goods, even disarmed shells, whatever might be there aboard the ship, that this was just sort of rubbing the Germans' nose in it, that they were doing this and getting away with it. And that therefore, not only should the British be taught a lesson, but the Americans should be shown what Germany is made of. Now, there were different counsels in this. There were people who were certainly going to counsel caution, that this would be something that could backfire, wouldn't be good, right. We don't have sufficient proof. And you can sort of imagine how these arguments would go. There are others who argued, no, this is exactly something we're doing. And this is where, from his position within the German council in New York, he's exerting his influence on this. I mean, after the ship is sunk, he writes an article talking about what a glorious action this was, extolling the virtues of it. Sooner or later, things were, the Lusitania, and this was, but simply because of its prominence, the fame and the size of the ship, was going to have some kind of unfortunate run-in with the U-boat. And on this particular day in May 1915, it did. So happened that the captain of the U-20 had a couple of torpedoes he hadn't used, and he sent them into it. There was a preliminary explosion, followed, most people reported, by another, and the ship sank very rapidly, carrying most of the passengers, 120 some odd of who were Americans, down to the bottom. And this, in the end, it did not bring the U.S. into the war, but it certainly was a key element. It definitely turned opinion in the American government opposed to Germany, and Wilson's administration was sort of halfway pro-British to begin with. I don't think they needed a lot of persuading. This is maybe the sort of key to this kind of action. What you're trying to do in something like this is not to get your target to do something which is fundamentally against their intentions or will. It's to push them over that tipping point. Okay. There were people in Washington who really wanted to enter the war against Germany, or at least had strong, feelings towards Britain. There were people on the German side who really wanted to do something like the Lusitania, and you get them to do it for you.
Right.
That's really the real secret of human relations, to get other people to do what you want them to do.
And so what does Crowley do later on? He takes some credit for being involved in that?
Well, the person he talks about to most freely about it is a fellow that he meets later on at the end of the 1920s, a young, actually sort of English-Belgian, a fellow by the name of George Lengelen. And that's a name that probably nobody knows, but I bet people know The Fly, right? See the movie The Fly?
Oh, that's right. This is the guy that wrote The Fly.
Right, and the story, he later became a kind of writer of science fiction stories. So George Lengelen's main claim to fame is that he wrote the original story, The Fly. Mm. But he also was a fellow who met Crowley in Paris around 1929, 1930. And Lengelen later on, he spent most of his life living in and guess what, of course, did Lengelen go into in World War II? British intelligence.
Right.
Certainly, yes. Every time you turn around with Crowley, it's the thing I find. They either were intelligence, they are in it, or they're going to be in it. And Lengelen wrote for a French magazine. This was never published in England. It's his sort of a recount. Lengelen says, this is basically what Crowley told me. that he talks about a particular meeting, which certainly he names the right people who would have been there, the German consul in Chicago, the German consul in San Francisco, Franz von Papen, the German military attaché, he also can. The other thing Langland does is to connect Crowley to this sort of larger British propaganda mission, which was something they were quite adept at. It's also something that they did in World War II.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. In the run up to World War II, Crowley again finds himself kind of in the middle of things, and I think you make a point really. Effectively, in Secret Agent 666, this book about Aleister Crowley, British intelligence, and the occult, you make the point that it seems just a little too coincidental that where things are happening that involve some invisible hand of espionage, there is Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, he does pop up at a lot of interesting places. Maybe just to step back a little bit, you were talking about where he was in the U.S. In the 5 years he was there, he was mostly in New York. But he shows up, you know, Montauk Point, shows up camping out in an island in a very interesting place up on the Hudson River, curiously close to Assistant Secretary of the Navy Franklin Delano Roosevelt's house. But he also visits Detroit, he visits Chicago, visits St. Paul. Then goes into Canada under some assumed name. Okay, this was sort of interesting. He makes a trip. He crosses the U.S. border into Canada, goes to Vancouver, goes to Victoria, B.C., then comes back into Seattle, makes a whole cross-country trip, visits New Orleans, the one city in the U.S. he said he really liked. But one of the interesting things is that, which will tell you something, is that when he goes into Canada, he isn't traveling under his real name, Edward Alexander Crowley. He isn't traveling as Alistair. He's apparently traveling under the name Clifford. And that's what he tells the people, his followers in Vancouver, that you're to call me Clifford, and I'm here on a matter concerning the security of the empire.
Now, that's so interesting.
They don't know quite what to make of it, but they go along with that. They call him Clifford. The thing, and what confirms this, is that, you know, you can find, got access, you know, looking at when people cross the Canadian border going in or out. There's no sign of him under Clifford or any. I know he went that way. It's in the same way that when he returns to England after the war, you suppose there might be people considering the stuff that he'd done that might be interested in arresting him?
Right. Or the things that he said against the British government or in favor of the Germans. Yeah, that somebody would pull him aside and say, excuse me, you're not welcome here anymore.
And, in fact, I can give you cases. There's one very prominent case of another sort of self-proclaimed international spy in New York in that period who wrote things embarrassing to the British. They had him arrested, thrown in jail, extradited to England, and put in prison for 3 years. Okay, if they wanted to get Crowley, they could have done it. It would have been very easy to come up with a charge against him. But nothing. He's not touched the whole time that he's there. Remember, at the one point when the Americans think they might arrest this guy, this is when the British consulate tells him, "No, he's working for us. We know everything he's doing. It's okay."
You know, there's so many things that he does, and we can talk. You can see more, read more about it in the book, and some of the things he's up to. But I want to pick a little bit more at the pre-war run-up. What do we know of what he was doing in Germany, and what was the public impression of why he was there? Why did he say he was going there? What did his own government think he was up to?
Well, he's mostly in Germany. There are a couple of maybe one way to sort of segue up to that. When he comes back from America, he's in Britain for a while. Then he settles in Sicily. He's going to start his own sort of religious school. He calls it the Abbey of Thelema. And that'll last until about 1923 when Mussolini, who's just come to power, has him arrested and kicked out of Italy. One of the things the Italians discover at the Abbey are documents emanating, as they describe it, from the Secret Service of the British Foreign Office, and also reports that Crowley had written critical of fascism in Italy. Hmm. Then he mostly spends much of the 20s living in Paris. There's this whole period, if you look at the book, in the 20s when he's clearly not comfortable going back to England. And I think what happened was that something If he hadn't screwed up before, he really did screw up in Italy. And I think the main screw up is that he was heavily addicted to heroin at the time. The drug habit really got good. He was making these attempts to kick it. And the stuff that the Italians found there, they shouldn't have found. He got
right.
careless.
He got careless.
And there are later people in London, you know, and you get this idea that it was because he's unreliable when the question comes up using him again. Then in 1929, the French kick him out of the country, okay? He'd been living there because they thought he was involved with drug dealing, which, you know, might not have been entirely off base.
Right.
But behind this, again, is this whole suggestion. The French won't come right out and say it, but they suspected him of spying, and they suspected him of spying more for Germany than for the British.
Well, if
now,
you,
this is – yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you actually looked at Aleister Crowley's life on paper, you looked at what he wrote, the idea of him being either a double agent or if you hadn't told me he was a British secret agent, I would have said from the very beginning when he arrived in the United States, he was really all about being an operative, being a provocateur for the Germans.
Well, that's one of those things. I mean, in this kind of realm, you can't rule anything out, and that's certainly one of the things that I considered. The one thing that mitigates against that is if you look at his activities in the U.S., and again, this is something you read the book and draw your own conclusions about, a lot of bad things happen on the German side. The presence of Crowley anywhere around the German apparatus never does them any good. I think there are other things working against them, part of which was just their ineptitude in many ways, but it certainly doesn't help them out. On the other hand, one way to look at it in the long run, if one of his main goals, if an important goal was to get the U.S. into the war, do they get what they want?
Right.
They certainly do. Now, how the degree to which Alan, maybe if he hadn't been there, the same thing would have happened. Maybe not. The point here isn't whether or not he's the key figure that brings the U.S. into the war, but he is playing part in a much larger, complex gambit, this kind of chess game, which is going
right.
on. The Germans lose that game. The British win it. Now, what he's doing, you know, the Nazis come to power in 1933, and really, after they come to power, Crowley's not welcome there. In fact, the Nazi regime, later on, they ban all occult organizations in Germany, except, of course, the Nazi Party.
Yeah.
And anything that he's touched with. And in fact, one of his key followers, a former German Secret Service officer, a guy by the name of Karl Germer, they actually jail. They throw into a concentration camp for a while, and the whole charge against him is that Germer had been recruiting followers for the infamous Freemason Aleister Crowley.
Hmm.
So they don't appear to like him. Yet there are these repeated stories. There's just that. How much truth of them is, I'm not entirely sure, that he does go back into the country.
Right.
That he may return to Germany in 36 or 37. That's not all that unusual because it's like, you remember I just mentioned that he was kicked out of France in 1929 and he was
right.
never supposed to come back? He does.
Right.
Lenglen and others met him in Paris when he's not supposed to be there. How does he accomplish that? Pretty simple. You do what you did before. You get a false identity.
Well, here was a guy who had some fairly strong bigoted viewpoints, right? He was an anti-Semite.
What do you want to be?
Well, fine, but I mean,
yeah.
publicly, his writings could be
yeah.
very anti-Semitic, and he mm-hmm. Here's Aleister Crowley, who influential in very liberal circles, yet he takes a very sort of traditional Victorian British attitude toward anybody who's not British, their sort of inherent inferiority. And he brings that, despite all of his, you know, other types of thoughts that some people consider to be progressive, despite all that, he was really, you know, let's just put it this way. If he and the Nazis had a lot in common, I mean, a lot of ideological viewpoints in common.
Yeah, I think, you know, if people explore out on the web and elsewhere, I think there's one site that actually argues that Aleister Crowley was Adolf Hitler.
What?
If you poke, I mean, that it somehow he switched places with him, or that Adolf Hitler was sort of his hypnotic puppet.
Well, I can almost believe that part, but I don't know if it switched places.
I can go maybe hypnotic puppet, but I mean, people will carry this to what seems to me to be considerable extremes, his connection between them. There's a French occultist or esoteric writer, René Guénon, who would later write a book arguing that Crowley became a kind of guru or advisor to Hitler. And that's really one of the things I'd have to say that I didn't, he would certainly make overtures towards them. And through some of his German followers, he would try to get copies of his writings to Hitler. There's no sign that he ever did. And again, later from the Nazis, from the mainstream Nazi reaction, he was clearly an unwelcome character. But the complexity of Crowley and his approach to this can be seen that he was doing the same thing with Stalin.
Right. Right.
In fact, one of Crowley's old magical buddies was a New York Times reporter by the name of Walter Duranty. He's been a very controversial figure in recent years because Duranty was the New York Times correspondent in Moscow, and he was accused, quite rightly, of slanting his reporting from Russia in the 1930s to make the Soviet regime look favorable. There's a book about him called Stalin's Apologist. This Duranty would write articles going, famine in the Ukraine, never heard of it. Okay,
right.
Never heard of it, that type of thing.
Right. Well, that would get him a job at, it would have gotten him a job at the New York Times back then, too.
Yeah, there was even talk, he won a Pulitzer, and there was talk a few years ago about revoking the Pulitzer.
Huh.
Because he was found to be lying. But here you've got a guy who's and you know, he and Crowley remain in some communication. So here's a guy, a British-born a journalist for the New York Times in Moscow with pretty tight connections to the Soviet elite. And so this is the same, Crowley will write to him. He makes these proposals to him a couple of times, go, look, the Bolsheviks have destroyed the Russian Orthodox Church. They need a new religion. I've got a new religion, Thelema, okay?
Right.
That will become the new religion of the Soviet state. Nobody on the Soviet ends of things really seems to bite on that, but it's a way, and there's sort of, part of it is, I think, Crowley's dogged determination to promote himself. I mean, I think he would have been thrilled if the Soviets had made Thelema the new religion.
Right. And well, in a way, there's some thematic similarities between Thelema and the Thule Society, which does end up taking hold in Germany. Well, that's about the time we have for Hang On. A little bit more, though. Coming up, we'll get back to R.B. Spence, who's standing by in the last hour on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your calls. Aleister Crowley, occultist, an inventor of a religion, which I think would be fair to say he was the Pope of. And could he have been involved in the sinking of the Lusitania? You take this where you're going to go, coming up with Richard B. Spence, expert on espionage, next on Coast to Coast AM. Talking with Richard B. Spence, author of Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult. Okay, so we'll get to your questions and comments, and we'll finish this conversation coming up next a little bit more about what was going on in Germany with the Nazis, as well as, your questions about this guy whom some people consider to be so evil, so inherently anti-God, anti-mainstream religion, that many people consider him to be Adolf Hitler himself, or even worse, the devil incarnate. And yet a British intelligence agent at the same time, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so Richard B. Spence, the author of Secret Agent 666, the rest of the story for Aleister Crowley, and as you said at the very beginning of the interview, there have been lots of biographies about Aleister Crowley over the years. This is the first one that really explores his connection with British intelligence. Is he typical, by the way, you mentioned before, other occultists that may have been involved in British intelligence, is it possible that he really wasn't then an occultist? Is it possible that all of this other stuff was really just a front to make him a more valuable agent for British intelligence?
There are lots of possibilities there. I don't think entirely, but let's say that there certainly are critics of Crowley. those who, I mean, there are those who see him detestable because he's supposedly satanic. There have been others who've argued that, that they think he's detestable just because he's an old faker.
Right.
You know, and I think that pretty much comes from the point of view that anything, you know, that the supernatural is bunk. I mean, if that's the view that you take, then anybody who's out promoting this stuff is a purveyor of bunk, and that therefore he's this was simply sort of fakery. I would think, and again, this is just my opinion, my take on the guy, is I think that his, you know, he was quite sincere most of the time in his spiritual quest, but there is this. There's a quality of an actor about him, and it's the same way that this is a person who could, for shorter or longer periods, assume different identities, could play. I mean, this is what, in a way, makes him good at this job of an undercover provocateur. He is convincing in the role he's playing. He could convince the Germans that he really was an Irish nationalist and anti-British.
Right.
There is an element, my opinion would be, throughout his career, in just about everything he does, of a degree of acting or fakery. But I think that there are other things about him that are quite, I think he felt that he had had, I mean, I don't know how Thelemites might feel about this. My sort of feeling is that he'd had real spiritual experiences. And if you look through his other biographies, you get an idea as to what those are. There was his real sense that he had gotten this taste of the other world.
Right.
That he had sort of reached out to the other side, but he couldn't maintain that. You know, there's this will-o'-the-wisp quality often to the sort of occult. And it appears, this thing walks into your life, it reveals this wider dimension to you, you think, and then it's gone. And people spend the rest of their lives trying to reconnect with that. I think he really was a seeker in that sense. You know, I'm not trying to legitimize his beliefs, and I'm not trying to attack his beliefs. And there was the one thing that I often think rings through. There's a little passage from him that I can read, and I think this sort of goes to the heart of his of why he would be willing to serve England. And you know, you'd made the statement, I think, early on that, you know, by serving British intelligence, he's that somehow places him on the side of the good guys.
Right.
Maybe not. Okay. I mean,
yeah.
Maybe opposed to the Nazis, yes, but it sort of goes on the assumption that we're often quick to make, that the British Empire is sweetness and light. You know, there are a lot of people who would disagree with that.
No, I get that, but I guess you're right. Framed against the Nazis, though,
yeah.
or people that would sink the Lusitania, pre-Nazi Germany. But, you know, even there, I think I followed it up with the question of, and maybe not. So, I mean, if even if he is an agent for the good guys, he does something evil. And I think it's fair to say evil in the murder of innocent life of people who are just crossing the Atlantic on the Lusitania, the same ship that he had crossed over on not that long earlier.
Well, let me read this little statement. This actually comes out of his confessions, which is basically an interesting name for an autobiography. But it actually comes to this point of basically he's answering the question as to why I would have served England. He goes, "I think the English pot as black as the German kettle, and I am still willing to die in defense of that pot. Mine is the loyalty of Bill Sykes' dog. The fact that he starves me and he beats me doesn't alter the fact that I am his dog and I love him."
That's very interesting.
It's the expression. It's one of those things. I don't know whether that's an admirable expression of patriotism or it's a perverted one, but it's one that's very intense.
Well, it's kind of sadomasochistic, and the sadomasochism, that's not that far away from Aleister Crowley.
And it may be, but part of what he's saying here is that he's not saying I'm serving England because I think England represents sweetness and light. He's saying I'm serving England because I'm English.
They're my team.
They're my team. That's it. All right.
As accident of my birth, they're my tribe, and that's all there is to it.
And this comes from, you know, this is a guy, it's odd because it comes from a fellow who spent most of his life thumbing his nose at polite society and paid a price for
it. Right.
I do think, you know, one of the things I've often suspected is that maybe it goes back to his upbringing, is that somewhere within Aleister Crowley, dissolute occultist, there was a conservative English gentleman screaming to get out. I do think there was someone who really, and he's very upset by the 1930s that the British press calls him these names, and he makes these abortive attempts to try to to try to restore his reputation.
Yet he still calls himself the Beast.
Yeah.
Make up your mind. Right? I mean, if you're the Beast of
Revelation, that doesn't mean what you think it means in some way. But
if you're the Beast of the Book of Revelation, then you are the most wicked. And so why parse words with the British press about you're not the most wicked man in the world and then call yourself in your own writings the Beast? You know, I mean, it sort of seems like he loses that case. Let's grab Joe on the wild card line to get us started for questions for Richard B. Spence, Secret Agent 666. Joe, a question for Richard?
Great, Joanne.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Richard about I heard him say Franz von Papen. I wasn't listening properly, but why did he mention that? What was his connection to Crowley? And what happened to von Papen when the Nazis lost after he? I guess it was him who led the slaughter against the Serbs, and he led it actually.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get an answer then, Richard.
Okay. Franz von Papen during the early part of World War I, was the Imperial German military attaché in the United States. And as such, he was more or less volunteered, and to some degree was roped into the various German intrigues in the U.S. He played a fairly prominent role. That's what eventually got him expelled from the U.S., I think, in the end of 1960. The Germans kept having this problem of getting their instead of maybe letting people like Crowley do the dirty work, they involved diplomats in it, which is always kind of a bad thing to do.
And aristocrats.
And aristocrats. But von Papen shows up again, and it comes back to this, Ian, you were asking about, Crowley and sort of waning days of the Weimar Republic in Germany, and this, that pre-Nazi regime that collapses and paves the way for Hitler. You'll find that Franz von Papen, used to be the military attaché, now emerges. He's briefly chancellor. And in fact, if you go and look at German politics, you'll find out that he plays a fairly important role in maneuvering Hitler into the position of chancellor. And in fact, for a while, holds a diplomatic role within the Nazi regime. And I'm fairly sure he ends up on trial after World War II. And I'm sort of racking my memory here, but I believe he's one of those who is acquitted or serves a short term. But von Papen is not a Nazi himself, but he certainly helps bring the Nazi regime in, does play a role in it. I can't connect him to the massacre of the Serbs, but he's a man with a very colorful career.
Yeah.
I also suspect that when he becomes chancellor, you'll find out that's when Crowley suddenly gets out of Berlin. I think there's a connection between those.
Yeah, they had a little history together. Is this Brandon, east of the Rockies, Fort Smith, Arkansas? Brandon?
Yeah. Earlier in the show, you mentioned about Crowley and music, and I kind of know where I think you're going with that. I'm a big fan of Jimmy Page, not so much Zeppelin, but Jimmy Page. I share a birthday with the guy,
sure,
and so on and so forth. Huge fan, but sort of obsessed with his career and everything. And when you read about him, you read about he had this huge, huge fascination, pardon me, with Aleister Crowley. And I was wondering if you could shed some more light as to what exactly his fascination was with Crowley, or what, Crowley's beliefs had to do with him,
With Led Zeppelin?
Yes.
Richard, have you done any research into the Zeppelin connection?
Probably pretty much know what I've heard. I didn't look too much into Led Zeppelin. Jimmy Page was the one thing I knew, most important, I guess, to me, was that he was a big, may still be, collector of Crowleyana, which supposedly included some. Crowley, again, wrote lots and lots of diaries, and those are often fascinating things to have because he's one of those people who would tend to sort of write down everything he did and everybody he met, at least those he wanted remembered. And Page was rumored to own a number of those diaries, ones that had otherwise disappeared. I was never able to establish that as true or not. There also was something about one point he bought Crowley's old Boliskin house in the Scottish
Highlands.
Yeah, I always thought that's – I thought he lived in a former Crowley house.
Yeah, I think that's the one that is. Now, again, Jimmy Page is the only one who could answer those questions, but his fascination – you know, he's not the only one. You know, Ozzy Osbourne has a whole song, you know, Mr. Crowley, as he says it.
Right. Right, right, right.
You know, the Beatles, for some reason, put him on Sergeant Pepper. You know, he has quite a following in the rock world, and I always wondered what he would think of that. Would he like the music? Would he be appalled by it? I don't know.
When Aleister Crowley wrote, did he refer to himself as the Beast 666? Did he make the connection? I know you put it cleverly in the title, Secret Agent 666, but I know he called himself the Beast, but did he ever go so far as to claim that he was the devil?
No, I don't. I mean, as far as I know, he never claimed he was the devil. It's even sort of questionable. You know, I think there was a guest on the show, Peter Lavenda, not too long ago, and I remember catching a question, is the argument as to whether or not Crowley even believed in Satan. In the normal sense, it might be. And here again, we're sort of going out on trying to analyze his beliefs, which is one of these things that, you know, it is fascinating to do. But I think even in that sort of quote I gave you, one of the things about him, his whole concept of sort of good and evil is very different than what most people might have.
Right.
I think part of it depended upon circumstance, and there are clearly things that most people might consider to be wicked or evil that he didn't see that way. The term that he used, and it actually came through an initiation into one of the OTO levels, he took the name To Megatherion, which in Greek means the great beast. He also took the title Baphomet, which is one of these, you know, terms that are connected to the Templars and
right.
About half everybody else. He gave himself lots of those names.
Right.
Okay. It was his mother who had branded him the Beast of the Apocalypse, and he seemed to accept it in that way. But I think he tried to interpret it in a different, I guess, it's maybe to put a positive spin on it. How he did that, I'm not going to say.
Right. And again, with his mother, it might have been with a little touch of humor that she referred to her Hellion child as the Beast. I mean, it wasn't necessarily because she really believed he was Satan. My wife and I will often use worse epithets than that for our kids. I have to ask Ted back at the studio, west of the Rockies. Ted, who's that on hold right now? Okay, Jerry on Coast to Coast AM for Richard B. Spence, author of Secret Agent 666. Jerry?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just wondering if he had are familiar with the name Edward Mandel House.
Yes.
Yeah, was there any connection between Edward Mandel House and Crowley?
Not any connection. The fellow that you're getting to was the a man who actually is a fairly important figure in American history that you never read about. He was the confidant and advisor to President Woodrow Wilson, a man that Wilson described as this sort of alter ego, and some people describe, rightly or wrongly, the sort of, you know, shadow president during much of that period.
Right.
The connection with Crowley would be this, is that we've got Crowley, and this is something we go into more detail in the book, the man who through much of the war ran the British intelligence operation in New York was a fellow by the name of Sir William Wiseman. Sir William Wiseman, no doubt about it, was sent over to further the goal of bringing the U.S. into the war, and he did it. And one of the ways he did it was becoming the friend and confidant of Colonel House, as he was called, and Colonel House had the ear of the president, and one of the results of this was that a British intelligence agent, William Wiseman, had free access to the White House and the ear of the president through Colonel House. Make of that what you will, and it's a complicated story, but in the sense that Crowley is connected to Wiseman's outfit, they're all, you know, there is sort of a circle there.
Okay. Let's go David in Ohio on Coast to Coast AM for Richard B. Spence, author of Secret Agent 666. David?
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. You know, my thinking along this line is the socialist, the Marxist connection ought to be looked into more.
And, I don't know what you mean by that.
I mean the elitists, they're more directed towards ideals than anything else. I think Mr. Crowley in his lifetime would rather be looked on as a loyalist than a traitor, but in reflecting back, that's his way of saying, hey, when Russia takes over the world, their Marxist society, right here, I am proclaiming I was involved in this.
Hmm. Richard, where are you with that?
Well, this is an interesting point there. One of the things I discovered, even though initially they said MI5, one of the places I made an inquiry was with MI5 because sometimes they preserve files and release them. And I was hoping they would preserve one. And initially they said they'd never had any files in Aleister Crowley. Now, apparently it never came to their attention, which I didn't quite believe. But subsequently came up with references to actually three files that they had possessed at one point, all of which had supposedly been destroyed. But one of those files had an interesting prefix, and the prefix was PP, and what that actually turned out to be was it meant peace propaganda, but it basically meant lefties. And in the 1930s, MI5, sort of the British FBI, if you will, had Crowley pegged in with communists and communist sympathizers. And they had some basis for doing that, because there's also a cross-reference to him in the file concerning one Louis Gabarty. And Louis Gabarty was one of the main communist international agents in Western Europe. Now, unfortunately, the file doesn't survive to tell us exactly what they were doing, but Crowley was in contact with a major Comintern official. So if you actually look at a lot of his connections in the 30s, much more so than a Nazi connection, he seems to be deliberately aligning himself with the left. For instance, you know, in the Spanish Civil War, he wrote articles supporting the Republic, the leftist Republic, against Franco, who was being backed by Mussolini and by Hitler. On the other hand, he, you know, some years before had been an Irish nationalist, and I'm not sure that any of those convictions. What it comes down to is that Crowley again would play these roles, and he would sidle up to different groups. I think part to try to just gain influence on, you know, our followers on his own part.
I
think under orders.
I got to jump here. We'll be back, and we'll get our last couple of calls in next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Vance has been waiting patiently in Asheville for Richard B. Spence, author of Secret Agent 666. Vance?
Hi, Ian. Very intriguing story there. I actually corresponded with Rick some 10 years or more ago about some other obscure figures with connections to British intel and the American Nazi occult underworld during the 1930s leading up to World War II, specifically William Dudley Pelley and his connection to Dr. A.E. Strathgordon and Howard Victor Braunstrup, of course, George Sylvester Viereck, and some of these other, shady characters, the usual suspects, many of whom were tried for sedition after the outbreak of World War II. Pelley served 7.5 years, in part because he claimed immediately after Pearl Harbor that it was a setup. And I just kind of wanted to get back in here and say, caught you by chance on here tonight, Rick, and it's really good to hear that you've continued with your very scholarly research and see if you could give us some insights on parallels between British intel before World War One and British intel in the American Nazi sympathy underworld leading up to World War II.
What an informed question. Thank you, Vance. Richard, where are you with that?
Connection between the two. I just want to say I do remember Vance, and yes, he and I did exchange a number of messages. They're very helpful. There is basically when World War II broke out in Europe, British intelligence resumed and or sort of reactivated a network that goes back to the First World War. And that's why I think understanding these two things is fairly important. In fact, one of the people who comes back into the fold is sort of, you know, or I guess put back into the saddle is the guy I just mentioned, Sir William Wiseman. Wiseman pretty much ran the show for most of World War One. he's brought back in as a kind of senior advisor, I suppose, to the guy who was put in charge of what was called British Security Coordination, run by Sir William Stevenson, who was a Canadian. And there's a biography of Stevenson called A Man Called Intrepid, which, as it turns out, is not particularly accurate, but that's another issue in itself. But it was the same sort of thing. I mean, what was British intelligence's main goal? What would you expect that they wanted in 1939 and 1940? To get the U.S. into the war as quickly as possible. In fact, they were facing a much more serious threat in many ways than they'd been facing back in 1914, 1915. They used all the weapons in the arsenal, propaganda, influence within the government. Certainly they had a great deal of influence with FDR and other people in his administration. They had to overcome a lot of opposition. And, it's one of those things that in many ways is it's a dirty game, but somebody's got to do it. And once again, they were successful within that goal. And to sort of understand that, if one looks at British activities and at the whole sort of game plan they're running in 39, 40, and 41, that's why understanding what had happened in the last war, which was a kind of learning experience for that, is important to put the two of them together.
I want to just give me 30 seconds, and I got a bunch of other people hanging on, want to talk to you, but
sure.
About the Nazi part itself, what was there? Were there Nazi British undercover agents posing as American Nazis?
I can't think of any offhand. They certainly had people within the organization.
Okay.
They were probably less concerned with the Nazis than they were concerned with things like the America First movement.
Tony's in Texas on Coast to Coast AM, wildcard line for Richard B. Spence, author of Secret Agent 666. It's about Aleister Crowley and his undercover espionage work in the United States, mostly leading up to the sinking of the Lusitania. Tony?
Well, thank you, Ian. I appreciate y'all taking my call this evening. We know that Aleister Crowley had a very public affair with Pauline Pierce, the mother of Barbara Bush. I mean, she looks just like him. Have you researched the possibility that Aleister Crowley may be the father of Barbara Bush?
I have not looked into that angle of it. That sort of fell out of sight of my
Wait. Hold on a second. Is this true that he had an affair with Barbara Bush's mom?
Pauline Pierce, yes, sir.
Is that true, Richard?
Well, not that I know of, but then
really?
He had affairs with lots of women. I've never...
Tony, why would you say that?
That's a new one, but you learn something new every day.
Where has that been verified? Where is that spoken of, Tony?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't have the information with me right now, but I just read it like maybe 10 days ago. You know, it was reported in the social magazines of the time and all this good stuff. But I don't have that information right in front of me.
All right. Well, let me look into that.
I don't have any verification that he's her father, but I do have verification that he and Pauline Pierce did have a very public affair.
I'll be darned. Well, very interesting. Well, I appreciate that. Never heard that one. Eric is in Boise, Idaho on Coast to Coast AM. Eric?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I have a comment and a question. I just want to say that Aleister Crowley's, all of his pursuits in the Kabbalah and the understanding of the tree of life and all his symbolism and everything, he reached a height of higher genius, but he just had knowledge without any balance of wisdom. And all that unconscious energy poured into Adolf Hitler, you know, giving him these ultimate ideas of bringing Germany's economic status up and to start the war. And anyway, just to let you know that I believe that Adolf Hitler was born 2 years after Aleister Crowley, and Aleister Crowley died 2 years after Adolf Hitler died. But anyway, my question is there any proof that Aleister Crowley worked for the British government in British government records? Or is that, you know, nobody knows that?
In terms of British archival materials, none of the intelligence archival materials are open. MI5 admits to having files on him. They won't say, they claim to have no knowledge of what was in the files, and those were supposedly destroyed. MI6, that I had some success in terms of getting information out of before on Riley, and I sort of hoped here, gave their standard reply that they would neither confirm nor deny that they had any kind of information on him. There are materials, in addition to Ian Fleming, one of the people who was another sort of follower of Crowley and who looked into him is a fellow by the name of, Robert Cecil, who was actually the secretary to the head of MI6, Stuart Mingus, during the Second World War. He mentions there was an effort, this is another sort of story, of trying to get Crowley out of England and into the United States, which didn't work out. But in terms of getting, it's like any other person who served as an intelligence asset, that's not the type of thing that is going to be widely discussed or actually put down. There aren't lists that are sort of kept and circulated around the government. Sure. Appropriately, the only person who really ought to know who he's running as an agent is the agent's case officer and maybe one or more other people.
Well, let's go ahead and get a couple other people on here in the time that we have. And I did, I Googled those two things together, Aleister Crowley, Pauline Pierce, the mother of Barbara Bush, and lots of different places have been making that connection. There's several websites that are throwing that out there, including some pictures of Barbara Bush, who does look remarkably like Aleister Crowley in drag. It's very weird. It's very weird. I've just never heard that before. East of the Rockies, Dave is in Cape Cod on Coast to Coast AM. Dave?
Yeah, hey, Ian. I heard that in 1917, the British Secret Service told Woodrow Wilson that there was a plot by the Germans to pay $10 million to Guerrero to Mexico go to war against the United States, and that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. And the U.S. got into the war in April. You know about that?
Yeah, that's. I think what you're talking about is the Zimmerman telegram or note, and that was actually a. You know, Mexico was also a neutral country, and it had differences with the U.S. In fact, during part of the war, there are thousands of American troops running around in northern Mexico chasing Pancho Villa, and there's a civil war going on. There are not good relations between the U.S. and Mexico, and the Germans had a lot of influence there. The U.S. had broken diplomatic relations in February, declares war in April. And there's a note that goes to Foreign Minister Zimmerman, and basically this is discussing, really what it says is that if the U.S. comes into the war, can we bring Mexico in to sort of distract the Americans? It's often not quite what is portrayed, that the Germans are plotting this, but they sort of assume that, that the Yanks are going to come into the war anyway, and under those circumstances, what kind of offer could we possibly get, would New Mexico, Arizona, California, et cetera, manage to bring Mexico's Carranza government in? That never came about, but nonetheless. And that was intercepted by British naval intelligence, who then passed it to Washington at the appropriate time, where it made quite an impression and certainly helped get the declaration of war.
Let's get west of the Rockies. Marvin is in Seattle on Coast to Coast AM for the book about Aleister Crowley, Secret Agent 666. You're talking with Richard Spence. Marvin?
Yeah, great. I was curious if he had seen anything about, I don't know if this is true or not, the captain of the Lusitania, not the one that was on board when it sank, but the previous captain had resigned just weeks before and written a resignation that supposedly is in the Naval Archives still, saying that he didn't mind carrying regular citizens or passengers through a war zone, but that, wait a minute, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. He said he didn't mind serving his country and going through war zones himself, but he didn't feel comfortable carrying passengers, and he resigned. I'm just curious if that story is accurate or if you can say anything about that.
I don't know. Where you might look for that would be... there are any number of good books on the Lusitania. There's one recently published, title which is Willful Murder. The author's name is escaping me. Certainly, you might want to go back and look in Simpson's book on the Lusitania and see if that occurs. There was a lot of controversy about whether the ship was going to be, whether it should be listed as a cruiser or not. There also may be a connection to this in terms of the Lusitania had a design flaw.
which was known to exist in other ships, and basically it had to do with the storage of coal and the inability to close watertight doors, and that's one of the things that that would lead to some of the problems with the ship.
Sure. Adam gets the last call from Eugene, Oregon, for Richard B. Spence, Secret Agent 666. Adam?
Hey, Ian. First time I talk to you.
Glad to have you.
Hey, did you know that the Lusitania was headed, I think, into a bay? It was headed away from the sub. The sub wasn't able to catch it, and then for some reason, the captain changed course and headed right into the sub's path. That's how the sub was able to torpedo it.
Do you have that, Richard, in your notes?
No, I don't think so. There's a lot of in that. You know, the technology of the time was that pretty much the sub had to be lucky. It had to be in the right place at the right time. And I mean, most of the evidence there. I mean, in the specific incident on that. You know, I think on the 7th of May in that case, I think it was a combination of bad luck for the Lusitania, and I guess in some way, good luck. For the U-20. Again, if it hadn't happened that day and on that run, it may have happened on another one.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, it didn't happen on the run that that Aleister Crowley was on.
No, and, not on that one.
And so, you know, maybe, just maybe they knew, don't get this one. He might be one of us, or maybe they didn't. Well, you know, it brings me to this discussion I was just kind of curious about. I don't think we have much time for it, but love to have you talk about it quickly. Your other book about Sidney Reilly, who's known to people who've seen the series about him as the Ace of Spies.
Mm-hmm.
You've done some research into this guy. He sort of seemed like the original, the prototype for James Bond. Other people say he's more like the model for a James Bond villain. Where are you with Sidney Reilly?
Well, Reilly is an intriguing guy, and in some ways, in comparison, Aleister Crowley is simple compared to Reilly. There's not much James Bond to him. And in fact, Fleming's whole statement there was that, Bond is something I just sort of made up. He's not a Sidney Reilly. And I think the main difference there was that Reilly was, you know, to some degree a real person, although in the very short time we'll have, main point here perhaps for those intrigued is that Sidney Reilly really wasn't Sidney Reilly. Okay? That is a kind of name which is assumed by a person who had many names. People who at the time described him as an international crook of the highest order are probably closer to the mark than describing him as the Ace of Spies.
Hmm.
He is a complicated and in many ways fascinating and sinister man who is connected to all kinds of people and all kinds of skullduggery.
Hmm. The idea of him being a supervillain is interesting because he certainly, I mean, if you saw any of the PBS series, The Ace of Spies, I'm assuming you did, that wasn't the side of him that they were promoting.
No, Sam Neill played Sidney Reilly, and that actually was a problem to overcome because so many people pictured Reilly as Sam Neill, and in reality, if you want to get the closest approximation, imagine Al Pacino playing Michael Corleone speaking with a heavy Russian accent.
Huh. That's Sidney Reilly.
Much closer to the real guy.
That's another book by Richard B. Spence. You can link up to him through our website at coasttocoastam.com. You can find out more about the book Secret Agent 666 and others. And so Aleister Crowley then will continue to kind of wait and see and find out whether somebody in one of the forgotten shoeboxes of history in a closet somewhere finds more that kind of fills in the blanks on the story of Aleister Crowley.
Yep, there'll always be more out there, and there'll probably always be blanks. But
okay.
Any kind of new information somebody has, I'm always interested to hear it.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much. It's a fun and interesting read, and like I said, meticulously researched. I love all of those footnotes. It was very helpful to know that it wasn't just pure conjecture that you were inserting in there. And if you want to find out more about the Barbara Bush, Aleister Crowley connection, supposedly, go to AboveTopSecret.com. AboveTopSecret.com. They have the picture of Aleister Crowley in his later years looking very much like Barbara Bush in her later years. It's really kind of scary. Above top secret. Thank you so much, Richard B. Spence.